So my name is Sarah Grimwood. I'm the Head of Portfolio Strategy and Operations for the Rare Disease Research Unit at Pfizer in Kendall Square, Cambridge. Really happy to be here. I'm your MC for today's session with Sai. So Pfizer has just over 2,000 employees here in Massachusetts, both at Kendall Square and also in Andover. We have a number of Pfizer employees in the audience, I'm pleased to say, but from both the Kendall Square and Andover site. And I'm also very pleased to say that we have a number of male Pfizer colleagues here today, because we believe at Pfizer that for gender parity, it's really important to have men as part of the conversation. So thank you for taking time in your day to be here. I'm also very happy that Pfizer's sponsored this conference. I actually chair the Women's Leadership Network for the Kendall Square site at Pfizer, and a few of us spent several hours putting together 11,000 of these little bags for you. So please take a look. And there's a chapstick in there, which you may find very helpful later on. Okay, so at Pfizer, we do strive to unlock the full potential of every colleague in order to drive higher performance, innovation, and to attract and retain the best talent. For a healthcare company, this is particularly important because you may not know that women play most of the decisions in healthcare, decisions for their families. So about 80% of decisions made for families are made by the women of the family. Also, women are often caregivers. They're often involved in making decisions about health conditions and treatments. So it's really important to have women at the table as we discuss, you know, what we need to do to bring forward great medicines to patients at Pfizer. So thank you all for participating in today's session, which is called Ditch Workplace Drama and Drive Results. I'm very excited. I've watched Sai's TED Talk, and I've read her book, so I'm really pleased to be here. It's going to be an amazing hour. So I'd like to introduce Sai to you. Sai is a drama researcher, a global thought leader, and she's a New York Times bestselling author, recognized for her counterintuitive, reality-based approach to leadership. You may have seen her. She's been featured on the Today Show, the Ask Gary Vee Show, in the Huffington Post, Forbes.com, and many, many more. Her groundbreaking ideas have helped thousands of organizations and individuals learn to harness the energy wasted in drama and instead use it to drive incredible results. So welcome, Sai. I'm really
looking
forward to this.
Thank you. Thank you, Pfizer, for your wonderful support of this conference. Pleasure to be here. You know, in my wildest dreams, I never had a plan that would involve me standing in front of any of you talking about leadership, calling you to practice a more modern form of leadership. I actually started out life as a therapist, as a marriage and family counselor, working with people who wanted to have more happiness and success in their lives. And I found myself promoted into a leadership role in an academic medical center. Now, I hadn't had any traditional leadership training, thank goodness, because I was able to instead use in my leadership actual evidence-based practice from what we know about human behavior and what we know about behavioral economics. So imagine one of my first weeks on the job in a perioperative area, that's where people come to get surgery and procedures done. I showed up for my job, and this particular nurse showed up for her first patient of the day. She went into the patient room, and she began preparing this patient for the procedure that the patient was about to receive. It's pretty routine work. You look at the electronic medical record. You get informed consent. That means that you advise people of what is happening, what the risk could be. You get their permission to continue. And you talk to them about what might happen post-recovery, how long this might take, and pretty routine. As the nurse was prepping the patient became absolutely hysterical. The patient began to sob. She was crying. She had a hard time breathing. She said, "I want out of here. Get me my clothes. Get my husband. I want to leave here. Do not touch me. And I don't want to hear anymore. I'm done." And of course, the nurse was really puzzled. And so she started to get some more information. And what she found out is that the patient was hysterical because there was a mistake in the medical record. The nurse was preparing the patient for a partial hysterectomy. The patient had come in for a nose job. Right? That's one of our biggest fears, I think, when we're, you know, preparing for surgery. And so the patient became hysterical, and the nurse, who cared a lot about doing a great job, became furious. And the nurse said to the patient, "This is unacceptable. I'll be back." And she left looking for a great leader. She found me. I was brand new on the job. I was walking down the hallway. She goes, "Wakeman, are you the leader on duty?" I'm like, "Yeah." And she began to tell me her story. "This is ridiculous, and admissions can't manage their way out of a paper bag, and heads should roll, and this is absolutely unsafe and unacceptable, and if I did my job like they did their job, I would be fired, and they don't realize how their small mistakes, them not caring about their work, make a big difference in a patient's life." Has any of you ever been in these hallway conversations? Now, I am pretty sure that my response surprised her. Many of you, traditional leaders, would have jumped in and got the facts and went to the patient room and started fixing some stuff. But that's not even in my DNA. So what I did instead is I said, "First of all, please take a very deep breath. Your brain needs oxygen right now." Right? There are only one nurse between the two of us. It was her. She wasn't breathing. I needed all of her. And then, because it's my own practice, I opened up my heart chakra, so hopefully she would know that I was an absolute fan, supporter, and I cared a lot about her. She knew I was on her side. And then I asked her a really simple question. I said, "You know, if you would do me a favor and just answer me this, if you were great right now, what would great look like?" And to her credit, she entertained this question. Now, this is pretty disarming, but you could see almost everything change. She was looking down and scowling and sharing with me her story, and she looked up, and you could just see her go to a different part of her brain. And she entertained that question. She said, "Well, you know, if I were great," and she had so many wonderful answers. She said, "If I were great right now, I would be back in the room, letting the patient know that we are very sorry about this, and it's actually evidence of a process that is working. See, we check with each patient about 5 times to ensure that a mistake would never reach them directly. It's why we do informed consent. It's why we do all these things." She said, "You know what? I could involve the provider. I could do a bedside staffing. I could bring everybody around the bedside and have the anesthesiologist, the provider, all of us nurses directly talk directly to the patient and help them understand that we're all very clear." She goes, "You know, I could use my training. I could turn the monitor towards the patient with transparency and have her see me fix the mistake." She had many, many, many ideas about what great would look like. And here's what I did as a leader. I said, "Oh my goodness, I love your ideas. Then go be great." And she did. Now, I checked in a few moments later, not to fix anything, but to show the patient additional support, to personally, as a visible administrator, to let them know that we took this very seriously, we're sorry for what they had gone through. And I asked the nurse afterwards, how did everything go? And she said, "You know what, Sai, it went fine." I said, "Wonderful." And I said, "Then what did you learn about yourself?" And she said, "I learned that when I was asked to be part of a process that I benefit from every single day, people check my work multiple times. But when I was asked to be part of that process, I didn't play that well. I got righteous and judgmental and called for people's heads to roll." I said, "Wonderful. Now that you know better, you can be better." And everything was fine. See, most hallway conversations that I've observed in my research were about 45 minutes in length for all the venting, judging, fixing, and, you know, discussions that have to happen later. This was like 5 minutes. So My question to you is, like, why would this work so well? Why do you think it would work so well? Am I some sort of nurse whisperer that I can take a very angry nurse in 5 minutes and plug and play them back into the room? What ideas do you have? Why do you think this might work so well? Anybody have an idea? And I'll repeat for you so everybody can hear. Yes. I redirected her back to her expertise, okay? And I redirected her not through any telling. A power of a leader is not what you tell people. It's what you get them thinking about. Okay, leaders don't manage people. They manage energy. I moved the energy from telling to reflecting. So, yes, there's plenty of other reasons. Who else had their hand up? What else did you want to add? Yeah, so I brought her back to her strengths. She's a wonderful professional who knows this stuff, right? I asked her, so I just refocused her more on what she could do. And a lot of us get into this view where I can't change everything, so I can't change anything. It's the ultimate victim, right? I can't change admissions and all this stuff, so I can't change everything. Yeah, what else? Anybody have something they want to add to that? Yes, here and then here. Yes. I totally shifted her mindset into accountability. We'll learn about that, where she could plug and play and have impact. Made her part of the solution. There was one more that had your hand up. Yes.
You really, you just, in that one sentence, shifted her identity.
Yeah. We all have these two selves, right? Low self is where we think people should be fired, heads should roll. Yeah, judging. And then we have high self. Same person, different identity, same body, both fully accessible to all of you. And this, I'll explain why all these things worked, is what I'm calling you up to do today is to practice a more modern way of leading. Much of what we have taught you has been ego-based leadership, and it will not work for where we need to go. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of changing people and doing things to people. And it's very invasive and aggressive. And it's power struggle. And it's, and my hope for you is that you step out beyond all of this. So here's a couple of reasons why this worked. I'm going to start with the most basic. The reason this worked is everyone knows what great looks like. Everyone. We all know what great looks like. The problem is we use this information to judge other people on. I know what great looks like. It's what you're not doing. It's what HR's not doing. It's what engineering's not doing. It's what my boss isn't doing. It's what my colleague isn't doing. I know what great looks like. It's what admissions isn't doing. We all know what great looks like. We use this information for evil, not good. If you can judge, you know what great looks like. We use it to judge others by rather than call ourselves up to greatness. Second reason this works has to do with how your mind works. You may not yet understand your own mind, but let me break it down simply for you. You have kind of two parts. You have low self and high self, same person. Low self is when I'm seeing the world through my ego, frontal cortex. It's like looking through the lens of ego. It's like wearing a pair of prescription glasses that are the wrong prescription. Everything I see is corrupted data. Low self, I'm judging, tattling, complaining, gossiping. I'm seeing all the things that can't be fixed. I am seeing myself as the victim. I believe that my circumstances are the reasons I can't succeed. I believe that my circumstances are the source of my pain. It's like you have a toggle switch. Imagine you have a light switch, a toggle switch on your forehead, and when it's toggled down, you are the victim. When it's toggled up, very different view of the world. You're back in your inner hemisphere. You're in your mammal brain. You are able to see so many options. You can identify hundreds of ways that you can have impact, that you can plug and play. You are compassionate. You're helping, not judging. You are all about doing what's great rather than scorekeeping and what's fair and what you should have to. Like, it's a toggle switch. And here's the cool thing about this setup. You can't be in both places at the same time. They're mutually exclusive. You cannot be in low self judging simultaneously while being in high self helping. It's binary, and that's the beauty. So how do you toggle up? An incredible superpower called self-reflection. A simple question for self-reflection toggles you up. Why? Because the brain can't be venting and self-reflecting at the same time. It's the ultimate life hack. Self-reflection is the ultimate drama diffuser. The way your brain works is a lot like a two-year-old. If a two-year-old had this clicker, the worst way to get the clicker away from a two-year-old is for me to grab the clicker. Any of you been around two-year-olds? Nice clicker. I'm going to take it because I'm more powerful. Look at the org chart, right? I could drag this clicker, or I could drag a two-year-old across the stage with a single clicker. I'm a therapist. You know what we actually do to test human development about the age of 24 months is we come in and we go, hey, nice clicker. And we make sure somebody's attached to the clicker when they're two. They go, I know. I go, that is a beautiful clicker. Did you see my water bottle? Do you want it? Now, a two-year-old is binary, just like you. They can't do a clicker and a water bottle at the same time. To get the water bottle, they got to drop the clicker. I don't grab the clicker. That's punching an ego in the face. Low self, ego, high self. I just bypass it. I go, do you want a water bottle? And they go, oh, yeah. And they have to drop the clicker and take the water bottle. I even wait for them to attach to the water bottle, and I go, or did you want the clicker? They go, dang it. This wonderful knowledge about the human brain is knowledge that we as leaders and colleagues and peers and friends can use. Rather than venting, we offer a question for self-reflection. It helps people toggle switch right into that part of their brain. It doesn't negate where they're at, it just moves them into a different place. Now, another reason that this works is we all have a profound natural craving to have impact. When I'm in low self, I see myself as the victim. There's no way I can have impact. And so my main option seems to be disengagement. When I'm in high self, I can see 100 ways to have impact, and my natural craving will lead me to plug and play. So this blows away any theory you've had about engagement, that engagement is something you manufacture by creating awesome environment for all your employees. It isn't. We know from our research that the amount of engagement in the workplace is directly related to the amount of self-reflection and ultimate accountability, not circumstances. In fact, circumstances in human behavior, we know only drive about 10% of your happiness or workplace engagement. 40% comes from the amount of accountability you take. So I have some things, hopefully, that will blow you away. How do I know this stuff? Weirdly, I'm a drama researcher. I had an accidental discovery led to a whole unexpected career. I study how much drama is in the workplace. Now, I define drama as emotional waste. Okay? Unproductive thinking and disruptive behaviors. So anything that's not helpful, anything that leads us away from results is the energy we study. Now, I have found that the average person spends 2.5 hours a day in drama. 2.5 hours per day of productivity just gone. These are good people, good performers. People that walk around going, this is sick and wrong. This is no way to run an organization. I should have been consulted. I can't believe that this is what's happening. Anybody just a little guilty? Now, let's look at the tiramizing opportunity here economically because it's 816 hours per year per headcount. So if you have a team of 10, do some math. Salary and benefits times 10 times 816 hours per year. You have an organization, you're going to start to see millions and billions of dollars adding up. Energy that can be upcycled and put back into play for innovation, breakthrough, collaboration, results, patients, customers, big stuff. We are looking so hard at how to find these little tiny breakthroughs, and the obvious one is here, and we have accepted this as a cost of doing business. My employees would come to me and they would go, Sai, I know I have some drama, but I'm just bringing my whole self to work. And I would say, stop it. I don't believe in bringing your whole self to work, folks. I believe in bringing your most evolved self to work and your most evolved self home and your most evolved self to your family. You can be toggled up or down, just not at the same time, same person, your choice. And so as I looked at this drama, I started to look at what the sources were, what drove this drama, and what we were teaching you in leadership that actually fueled the drama rather than diffused it. Now, I noticed that between the years of 2006 and 2016, that the amount of time in drama actually increased from 2 hours a day to 2.5 hours a day. And a lot of people are like, those dang millennials. So we checked that for you from our data, and there is a difference by age group in who seems to have just a tiny bit more drama, tiny. And it would be people 50 years and above have the most drama. Mostly judging millennials and complaining about technology, right? Because see, if I can judge a millennial, I'll never have to marry up to the fact that I didn't keep up with the times, and so I'll just judge you rather than lead you. Now, that's a problem, that we have this increase in drama. So I went to my training and development folks. I said, aren't you guys like training people? They go, Sai, we're doing more training. We're offering more courses. We're putting more dollars into all this learning and development where we have more dollars, more courses, more hours. I go, well, the drama is increasing. You're spending all this money and you're getting more drama. Does that worry you? Is anybody questioned on whether we're training people on the right things? Is what we're teaching people working? And they kind of skirted the question. They said, you know, we don't just do it for that. We do it to increase engagement, which I think we have all wrong. But I said, okay, well, how's engagement doing? So if you're doing all this increased training, isn't engagement off the charts? And oh my gosh, it has stayed completely flat, but only for 15 years. And then I said, isn't it time that we start to wonder if traditional leadership tools and programs that we're investing millions and millions and millions of dollars in are working? And my answer to you is, I don't think so. So here are the sources of drama. 32% of all drama arises out of what we call ego behaviors. Venting, tattling, scorekeeping, judging, venting, 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 scorekeeping, judging, tattling. How many of you believe people need to vent? How many of you have been told, keep an open door, be there for your people? When I first heard that as a leader, I was a therapist and they made me a leader, and then when I finally went to leadership boot camp, they go, Sai, keep an open door. I go, that sounds boundaryless. We need to be there for people to vent. I'm like, well, we would never want people to engage in venting. It's a behavior, not a feeling. It's very dysfunctional and unprofessional. I would not let a client vent. I'll let you share a feeling. I'm so frustrated with Alex. He didn't give me the information I needed. Feelings take one sentence. I go, wow, sorry to hear that. You sound very frustrated. That would be the end. Like, we've shared our feelings. I would say, do you like the feeling of frustration? Is that something you want to remain in that situation? You go, no. I go, perfect. Let's talk about strategies where you could end up less frustrated. What ideas do you have? Well, I could just not worry about it. It's not even my business. Oh my gosh, letting go and minding your own business is a very healthy strategy. So that sounds fabulous. So what else would you like to talk about in our session? Yeah, but he shouldn't just get away with it. Oh, we aren't letting go. Okay, so back to the strategy, right? Well, I probably he can't read my mind. I should just ask him directly for what I want. Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. Would you like to role play that? But most of us let people vent. I'm frustrated with Alex, and he does this crap on purpose. And if you go back to the merger in 89, it was because we got different titles. And when we got different titles, it's absolutely ridiculous, because then that is when our careers really split. And I got put off as a BA, and he got put off as a specialist, and it's never been the same. And if you know him, if you see him walking down the hallway, you'll see the smirk on his face and why I'm like... See, venting is a story we made up to justify and keep our feelings alive. Feelings we share so we can get rid of them. Venting we share so that we can keep them. Oh, and another thing. So, remember I was talking about Alex yesterday? I remembered another thing, because I really want to keep my hate alive. I want to be right, and I want to really prove this. Right? So we have a whole open door policy around venting. See, now we have to really look at what we allow people to do and whether it's helpful or not. Accountability, most people don't understand accountability. They want to hold somebody accountable. They want to make somebody accountable. And what I would tell you is you probably can't unless you want to get very legalistic. And even our justice system seems profoundly biased and not holding people accountable. And so all you can do is stop enabling people. You can't really hold them accountable, but you can stop enabling them. Right? People come up to me all the time, so Sai, I have this rock star, and she is pretty much unfit for human consumption, but she's a total rock star. And they go, okay, let's stop enabling. Stop calling her a rock star. If she's unfit for human consumption, she is someone about to be on performance plan. But we enable people by justifying and by protecting and by not acknowledging. And third source of drama is buy-in. People actually forget that buy-in's a verb. Buy-in's what you have to bring to the table, otherwise we can't work together. I can't manufacture buy-in, it's a verb. You have to be willing, and I can only work with the willing. I have 8 sons. In our house, we use big data. We know that when you turn 13, the likelihood of you getting grounded goes up. Okay? So when you're 13, the first thing I do around your 13th birthday is I teach you to play poker. Now, why? Because when you're grounded, we don't let you slink off to your room and play Fortnite. When you're grounded, you spend more time with your mama just to help those values get reinforced. Now, mama likes to play poker. Mama don't live in Las Vegas. So I teach you to play poker, and then when you're finally grounded, on Friday nights, I play poker with the groundeds. I found some of the groundeds weren't that motivated. They would just slink in their chair. I'd ask them to play their card. They'd just throw whatever card was there. They weren't that motivated, and so I had to add one thing in, that they play poker with next week's allowance, so it's double jeopardy, so that they care about how they're playing. So I teach Charlie to play poker. And Charlie finally gets grounded, and it's Friday night, I'm playing poker with the groundeds, and I go, Charlie, I dealt the cards, this isn't practice anymore, place your bets. He goes, well, Mom, before I bet, I want to see your cards first. I'm like, sweetheart, that's not how poker's played. You're betting on you, your cards, your risk tolerance, your skill set, and as the stakes get higher, we show more and more, place your bets. Mom, I don't want to risk my allowance. I want my allowance, and I want to make sure I'm going to win, so please show me your cards, and then I'll bet. And I realized that, like many of us, Charlie was exhibiting this weird behavior we get into at work. I'm totally in as long as you make sure that everybody does the same amount of work and that it's never unfair and that my boss is always perfect and I get paid equally for every single thing I do and that we have perfect communication and no change and priorities that don't change. And I'm never really asked to clarify or have a tough conversation. And then seriously, I'm super in. Why? Do you hear how conditional many of us are? Change blew me away. 13% of all drama is change. This is horrifying. I gave my first talk on change in 1989. This is 30 years ago. What other competency do we give people 30 years to get good at? We are so emotionally blackmailed about change. How many of you have told people change is hard? Okay? It's not. See, if change were hard, you would all experience it as hard. If change were the hard thing, it would be the variable that everybody experienced equally. But change is only hard for the unready. Whether change is hard or not for me is my readiness level. So let's say that I have a colleague, and you're my employer. You give us new smartphones, and we're asked to do everything on the smartphone, email, PowerPoint, everything. This is our new technology that we are going to use fully at work. Now, I stay technically very savvy, so I simply go to the cloud and download my stuff onto my new smartphone. It takes about 5 minutes, and then I'm in the ballgame, and I'm just discovering some cool new features about my new phone. I'm very grateful to you. I want an engagement survey so I can put your name on it. Thank you for giving me great tools to do my job. Now, my colleague, who's had the same flip phone since high school, he has skipped 27 upgrades. He has curled up in a fetal position And he's wondering when there's super user training and if we get time to adjust and if he can have a scribe that travels with him to help him use his cell phone for the next few months. Now, is change hard? Because if it were, it'd be equally hard for us, or is it just hard for the unready, the person who skipped all the upgrades? And we are enabling so many people through change. And then some of the things we believe about engagement are pretty messed up, and there's a category of 10% that just wasn't statistically significant. But when you look at how traditional leadership handles each one of these things, we actually are fueling the drama, not diffusing it. And it's really time for a new approach to leadership. Now, a lot of people, when I say, what's a leader's role? They say to motivate others. As a therapist, I know that's completely impossible. I can't motivate you. Motivation's your choice. I'll give the same talk to many people, some motivated, some not, same talk. Inspiration, in spiritu, Latin verb, means to breathe. I cannot breathe for you sustainably. I do know advanced life support. I could do it for a while, but it just isn't how we want to work together. My job as a leader, I believe, from my research, is to eliminate emotional waste, drama, like we do any other waste. If you have waste in the workplace, how do you address it? Through a process. Emotional waste, how do you address it? Through a good mental process. We actually have a large call for process improvement mentally for people to really show up and be their most evolved self. What's a good mental process? What would great look like? Perfect mental process. Next time that nurse is in the room and she sees an error in the medical record and she's like, this is ridiculous, I gotta go find Wakeman. She's just gonna ask me what great would look like. I'm just gonna stay here and be great. That's a good mental process. It is a technique that lives inside her now, and evolution favors what works and feels good, and it works and it feels good, and it will be favored in evolution. Right? So that's a simple, good mental process. But most leaders jump in and fix and enable and collude and sympathize and feel bad for the guy who skipped 23 upgrades and wonder how we can help them. And right? Instead of just calling people up and stop all the enabling. Let's take this in real life. When the going gets tough, if you're a human being, you'll respond in predictable ways. I just expect this. So if I came and you were my company and I said, we're going to do more with less, we're going to deliver aggressive agendas with limited resources, it's going to be awesome and competitive and it'll be disruptive and it'll just be a blast. Every one of you in the audience, if you worked for me, would fantasize at least for a minute about quitting. Every one of you. You'd fantasize about being the Walmart greeter girl. Like, that job looks easy. How many of you fantasized? Yeah, about winning the lottery, about great Aunt Rhoda, who's had a wonderful life, passing away and leaving you the cabin in the woods to write the great American novel. Like, in some way, shape, or form, we fantasize. And in fact, Gallup says that 71% of Americans actually quit their jobs every single day. 71%. Isn't that phenomenal turnover? Now, they keep coming to work and getting a paycheck. Because what they're measuring is active or passive disengagement. And the average organization has 71% actively or passively disengaged. And we are organizations full of victims. Gallup also says that 51% of the people who leave their jobs leave because of their leader. We did similar research. We know that they leave their job and blame their leader. Very different. Gallup asked everybody who left, why'd you leave? They said, my leader. So we follow people through four different jobs, the same people. We thought it would take a 15-year research period. It took about 3.5 years. And they left every job because of their leader. Now, what's the statistical odds of you having four bad leaders in a row, so bad that you would need to quickly... See, there's so many things skewed out of this view of the ego where we are enabling people and not calling them up to greatness. But most people step down, they quit... But that doesn't feel good. We have this natural craving for impact. And so when I quit, the ego jumps in and goes, well, Sai, you had to, and starts to justify that with what I call BMW driving, which is bitching, moaning, and whining. If you are venting, it is an indicator that you recently stepped down. It's the cover-up. And when we vent and we bitch and moan and whine and vent, we usually do it in the meeting after the meeting. We don't have a lot of integrity. In the meeting, we go, Cy Wakeman, you're the best boss I've ever worked for. It's a gold star on my resume to be part of your organization. And then the meeting after the meeting, where you all gather in the cubes and the bars and the parking lots, is you do this thing where I'm so in. I'm totally in. I just need a bit of a different reality. I'm so in, but they're going to need to give us more money and better IT systems, and everybody's going to have to be held to the same standard, and they're going to have to really make it fair. And I'm super in, but we're going to have more staffing, more money, more time, less this thing called reality. Anybody played that game? I would be a rock star if only reality was perfect or different. Yeah. A lot of us get really empowered because we're talking to each other. Instead of calling each other up to greatness, we collude and vent with each other. And so we make these bold moves. We're like, I need to be assertive. I'm going to go to my boss and say, I'm all in, but here's a list of terroristic demands that I need for you to change in order for me to be successful with my work. Most of us focus on changing reality, but what I'm here to tell you is a leader's focus needs to be calling people up to their high self, and then seeing reality from a different place so that they can grow where they need to grow, so that they can move more skillfully through the reality at hand. See, you can argue with reality all you want. It's just an argument you'll lose, but only 100% of the time. The people who add value are the people that can add value in this reality, that succeed in spite of the facts, right? That can move through reality skillfully and peacefully. There's two ways to go through reality, joy or misery, same reality. One is swimming through mud, the other is walking through air. It's effortless. It has all to do with just consciousness. Everything opens up when you approach life from a different level of consciousness, and it's time we brought that into leadership. Let me give you an example. I know that your happiness isn't correlated to your circumstances. As I said, it's correlated to the amount of accountability you take for your circumstances. Sean Akers here, he will tell you this. Listen closely to his work. It's fantastic research. Fantastic research. I had a team of HR folks, and we worked in the academic medical center. And we had a generous donor who gave us money to build both a heart center and an ambulatory care center in the same year. What that meant was that our facilities plan was complex, right? We had this mad Tetris game going on. Anybody been part of where you're going to move here, and then we'll move in here, and then we'll move you back around here, And HR was asked to move more than its fair share. We were going to move 3 times in 1 year, but you know what? We were fine with it. Should you move patients on ventilators or HR with filing cabinets? We got it. First move we made was into the old nurses' college. They were doing construction above us, and it was kind of a crappy office, but we were good until we got really horrible headaches. So I called employee health. I said, my entire team has headaches. Can you come check us out? It's weird. And they came and they took our blood and they left us a pamphlet on lead poisoning. And they moved us out kind of in the night. So my team was a little bummed about the loss of IQ points. I wanted to cheer them up, so I scored temporary offices in a place where we could see our new offices being built in the Heart Center. And so we were so hyped. We were watching them go up, and then all of a sudden work stopped. Then we saw them being torn down, and we're like, what? And they found that our offices were being built on Native American burial grounds that was undocumented. And so we did the right thing, which is work with our Lakota Nation neighbors and tear down the building and put in a beautiful garden to honor their ancestors. And my team knew that, but it was just a little hard when they saw their offices being torn down. I walked into work one day, and my team had heard that they were moving for the 5th time in 18 months, and they had torches and pitchforks. And their heads were like, we're not moving. And I'm like, come on, you guys, let's take it for the team. Turn that frown upside down. Come on. We're awesome. They said, sign, none of that's going to work this time. They're like, we're done. And they started talking about engagement. They're like, what about our engagement? We live out of boxes. We're nomads. We don't have the tools to do our work. We don't have best friends, and if we did, they couldn't find us, Cy. And then they pulled out the disaster recovery plan. They go, we're not even on it anymore. If this building blows, like, no one even comes looking for us. And that just got my heart. I'm just like, oh my gosh, okay, let me help. So what can I do for you? They go to the CEO and tell him to stop moving us. So, girlfriend, I'm doing that. My people are suffering. I got all fired up. I went up to the glass hallway. I go, I need to see the CEO, Doug Johnson. My people are suffering, and I'm here to represent. We're going to have a little come to Jesus about how to treat my people. And I brought our acrylic awards. We were award-winning. We had acrylic awards from Sherm, and I brought them up with me, and I was just going to lay it on the line. I was surprised when I demanded to see the CEO. They started dialing for dollars, and the support person's on the phone. She's like, yes, get him in here immediately. Yes, we need him now. Wakeman needs to talk to him. I was a little surprised. I thought, dang, I didn't realize I had that influence. And so I'm waiting for Doug. Now, what I didn't know is they had promoted me pretty early in my career, and they were worried about me committing career suicide. So a group of women who fostered and supported and sponsored my promotion put a support plan in place. They taught the administrative support people that if I was ever in the glass hallway demanding to see the CEO, that they would pretend to call him. And they would call my mentor instead, and code would be, yes, she's right here. Yes, come immediately. Now, I didn't know this, so I'm waiting for Doug Johnson, and I turn around, I'm like, Sister Mary Catherine, what are you always doing here when I'm trying to see Doug? And she's like, oh, sweetie, I don't know. Just coincidence, I guess. What's up? I go, my people are suffering. And she goes, they're suffering? Like, why? I go, because we move all the time. She goes, oh, I know that that's your reality. I'm just wondering why they're suffering. I go, because we move all the time. She goes, no, sweetheart, the reality is you are asked to move for the fifth time. I'm just wondering why your team is suffering. Suffering's always optional. Dang it. Grasshopper. And here's what I realized with self-reflection. My team wasn't suffering because we moved. My team was suffering because we had not yet gotten mobile. It was our skill set. See, when people tell me these jobs are undoable, I usually agree with them. Yes, given your current skill set, your current approach, and your current level of willingness, I would imagine they're undoable. But that's not the job's fault. That's your skill set, approach, and willingness. And I sat there and I thought, my team is suffering because after four moves, we haven't yet gotten mobile. And so I went back to my team. I said, team, we need to get mobile, and then moving won't hurt. So let's imagine that we want to be mobile. If they call us and say, can you move Monday? I want our response to be, what are you doing in 5 minutes? If that's what we create, how are we going to get there? And my team was like, well, we shouldn't have to. I go, that wasn't the question. The question was, how could we? See, a leader manages energy away from why we shouldn't have to and why we can't to how we could. You're about to be great. You're like, what would great look like? And then you know it, and your ego goes, yeah, but you shouldn't have to. And you're like, dang it, you were almost great. That's the ego's favorite little jab. So people started to brainstorm. I said, well, how could we be mobile? Because if we were mobile, moving wouldn't hurt. And one person said, well, we could become nomads. We could just become little backpack HR people. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's awesome. This was before HR business partners. This was the 90s. I'm like, that's amazing, but it's got to be budget neutral. How can we be mobile? Like, well, we could get backpacks. I'm like, where can we get those? Marketing gives them away at health fairs. I'm like, go Saturday, get five. What else? Somebody came to me and said, my husband works in biomed, and we were talking at dinner last night, and the cell phone companies want us to quit using pagers and use cell phones, but obviously not only can we not afford them, but we don't know if they interfere with heart monitoring systems, so we were just dreaming that what if we got the cell phone companies to give us free cell phones for a year, and biomed studies them, and 1 year later, not only did my team have free cell phones for a year, but they were published in the National Journal on their partnership with Biomed and how HR can make a difference in innovation in the 90s by helping figure out whether they interfere with heart monitoring systems. Part of the reason you can use cell phones in hospitals today has to do with my HR team. You're welcome. Somebody else came to us and said, we're going to need laptops. It was the early 90s. I'm like, you guys, we're never going to get laptops. And then somebody said, remember the radiologist got a new system? They got laptops to read x-rays at home, but they wouldn't even take them out of the boxes because they're so tech-adverse. I go, I remember. in disguise. So I may have replaced them with equal weight of bricks, and we have new laptops. So now my team had cell phones and laptops, and we started to work from home on Fridays, and no one even noticed. They didn't even know it was possible. It was 93. One day payroll didn't go well, and they called me. They said, Sai, we need all hands on deck in HR. We need you to meet finance in your office. We got to straighten payroll out. We'll be there in 5 minutes. And we're like, no, because on Fridays we worked from home, but we didn't really run that by anybody. Imagine the scandal that broke out when HR was found to work from home with laptops and cell phones that no one in the entire organization had. First, I had to figure out what work from home was. They were kind of like the Senate grilling Facebook on how do you make money, right? So we went in to help with payroll. I thought we'd all be fired. So we're like, wherever you go, bring the rest of us. We're getting all of our resumes together. I was shocked. The CFO got so mad about this, he went to the CEO to complain about us like I ever would do that. And he went up there and he goes, this is ridiculous. And the CEO surprised me. He said, Wakeman's team, they get great results. They can work from Tahiti as far as I care. He said, your team, I'm still waiting for my budget variance reports from last month. You should stay put. And my team learned an incredible lesson. What? Your circumstances aren't the reasons you can't succeed. Moving? That's not it. They're the reality in which you must succeed, right? And that's what they came away with. And they also came away with this. Don't ask for benefits on the promise of results. Deliver results and benefits follow. And the mistake I see a lot of people making today is they ask for all these benefits. If I had this and this and this, I could produce. And I'm telling you that if people go, how do I get valued? I go, add value. Like, drop all your other stories. You want to be valued? Then add value. Like, and then ask for what you're worth. But first, you got to add the value part. So a lot of folks don't realize how powerful this can be. But if you worked for me, on the back of your badge would be, how can I help? And one of our non-negotiables is stop judging, start helping. And if you came to me, I would do things differently when you were all set to tattle. Let me give you some ideas about what this looks like. I walked into a Monday morning session. We had done a data conversion over the weekend, and at one of our sites, it didn't go well. And I was met at the door by Tammy. She walked in. She goes, Sai, have you heard about the weekend and what a cluster it was? It was absolutely ridiculous, and IT's trying to kill us, and I don't know how Karen keeps her job, and you know, she went on and on and on. And the first rule of a leader is to get people diffusing all drama. So if you came to me and you go, we had three projects dumped on us, I go, we have three new projects? See, I just translate. When she came to me and she's like, IT's a mess, I go, oh my gosh, I love that you're in my office sharing your care and concern for our colleagues in IT. Sounds like they had a tough weekend. I'm just wondering, what did you do to help? See, she wanted to vent and collude and have me sympathize and blast IT. They're our colleagues. She said, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. And I said, oh my gosh, it sounds like they had a tough weekend. What did you do to help? She's like, well, I haven't really done anything. I'm in here telling you. And I go, oh, just to be clear, coaching-wise, that's not helpful. Talking about another group, like, that's never helpful, ever. Like, do you have your badge with you? Yeah, awesome, come with me. Who are you mad at? Karen? Awesome. Karen, Tammy was just in my office sharing her love and concern about your IT team, and she has a question for you. Go ahead, Tammy. Tammy's like, how can I help? And Karen had a bunch of answers. See, Tammy was venting because she'd recently stepped down. Karen said, you know, when we have business requirement meetings, you tell your team they're not mandatory, and so we find on the day of conversion three systems we didn't know about, not that helpful. So your venting was just a cover-up because you didn't make your team follow project management methodology, you dirty dog. Now, here's her mental process. I am going to go throw my colleagues in IT under the bus. I'm going to go tell Wakeman that they stink. She's just going to ask me what I did to help. I think I'll just go directly to Karen and ask. Good mental processes. Very clean stuff. My message here is you have to insist that people stop judging and start helping. A lot of people go, Sai, I'm not the boss. I need to be empowered. I'm like, empowerment is stepping into the power you already have. We step down hundreds of times a day. We join in and collude. We get in low self. We barter with people. And I hope by now you're starting to understand that your ego just may not be your amigo. In fact, I would love for you to get very suspicious of everything you think. Another way that people don't understand their own minds is they think they're the ones doing the thinking, and you are not the one doing the thinking. You're being thought. Many times, very corrupted data. If you don't believe that, when you wake up tomorrow, notice this. When you wake up, do you go, I shall begin thinking now? You wake up, you're already being thought. See, you're not the one doing the thinking. You're the one observing the thinking. And you, if you want to be happy, should question everything you think. And if it causes you stress, know automatically it's just not true. See, people say people need time to vent. Venting helps. Venting feels good. Yes, it does. So does crack cocaine, I've been told. But we don't want you doing that at work. But here's what you need to know. Venting's the ego's way of avoiding self-reflection. You can't self-reflect and vent at the same time. Self-reflection is the foundation of accountability, and accountability is death to the ego. Self-reflection is what drives this toggle switch to move from low self to high self instantaneously. The simple act of self-reflection moves everything to a different space. It seems to be the ultimate drama diffuser. Questions for self-reflection? There's many. What can I do to help? What do I know for sure? What could I do next that would add value? What would great look like? All of these will work. Our job as leaders is to stop arguing with reality and help people embrace reality and to move beyond their ego and to answer that call to greatness and see things from a different level of consciousness and to help people understand that your suffering is completely optional and most often self-imposed. See, we don't suffer from our reality. We suffer from the stories we make up about our reality. Let me give you a couple of ideas before we close. I worked for a man named Robert, and if you would have taken me out for a drink, I would have filled your ears for a while with how Robert is a micromanager. He treats me like a child. It's absolutely ridiculous. He double checks all the time. He does this, he does that. And then I took the wrong girl out for a drink. She wasn't going to collude with me. I go, my boss is a micromanager. And she goes, oh, really? What does he do? I go, well, he, like, micromanages me and stuff. And she goes, well, let me draw you two columns. What does he do? I go, he, like, calls me. Sometimes twice a day. And then she goes, in the next column, and you make that to mean, well, he's an obvious micromanager. Does he give you any budget? I go, yeah, a couple of million. And she goes, and you make that into treats me like a child? And she separated out my reality from my story, which was the cause of my suffering. And you know, after working with her, I realized this beautiful question, what do I know for sure? And how it releases my ego's grip on my reality. This micromanaging boss became a boss who preferred more detail than I liked to give. This one question, what do I know for sure? My ex-husband, who was trying to steal my children from me, became a guy who wanted an extra day at Thanksgiving with his own kids. It changed everything, this one question. I was working on no ego with Robert, just sticking to the facts. He called me up and he goes, Sai, I just want to check in on Project Zebra. Oh, that almost triggered me. He names every project after an exotic animal. And I think he does this on purpose, so when I present in front of the board on Project Platypus, I look like a damn fool. But I got out of it. I just stayed in column one. He asked me for a project report. I looked up the stats, so I go, I'm 3 weeks behind. He goes, oh my gosh, it seems like you're behind on a lot of things. Oh, that almost got me, except it was so true. I just went inside, is it true I'm behind on a lot of things? I go, I've noticed that about myself too. See, nothing he has said or asked is untrue. He said, well, the board's coming in next Thursday. Get Project Zebra ready to go and present it perfectly because they're going to want to take a look at it. I have no ego involved. I'm just like, oh, my gosh, Robert, good talk. I'm going to take all my extra energy and put it into Project Zebra. There's nothing wrong with this talk. I get off the phone, my ego starts to put the pieces together. My ego goes, Cy, do you actually believe that of 150 projects, he just picked out Project Zebra just out of the blue? Don't you get where this is going? He did that intentionally to discredit you with the board because you've heard there's reductions in workforce coming on and the board loves you, and so he's going to have to pick out your worst projects to discredit you in front of the board, so when he wants to get rid of you, then they understand why. And, oh my gosh, I'm going to be fired. That's what's happening. And I have a kid in medical school, and he'll have to drop out. And you guys, he wanted to help kids in Uganda, and now kids in Uganda are going to die. Has anybody gone from a call with your boss to... See, your suffering didn't come from the phone call. It came from the story you made up about children in Uganda dying. I get to take wonderful people hiking. This is a group from Google who mapped the human genome. And we're on a mountain. The view is spectacular. The company is spectacular. And I am just so grateful. I feel like I've won life's lottery. It's just this glorious moment. I stop to take it all in. I'm like, they pay me to do this incredible work. And I went to walk on, and I see something slithering on the path in front of me. And with a single thought, snake, that glorious moment that I just had was gone. Everything's changed. I'm hyperventilating. I have major organ systems shutting down. I have to pee like a pack mule. Like, it's horrendous. I need a plan. I am about to get bit by a poisonous snake, and I'm in Mexico, and I'm going to be life-vacked in the Mexican chopper to some hospital I don't know the name of. I probably am going to die. I need a plan, and I can't think. John Wayne comes to mind. Weird thought. He was in a movie once where he got bit by a snake and he cut an X in his hand and sucked the blood and the venom out and spit it out. Anybody remember this? So I got my hand on my pocket knife. It's the only plan I have. I'm ready to do surgery on myself. I'm walking towards the snake. Somehow I'm like getting closer and I'm thinking this through. I'm like, okay, I just have to cut an X in my ankle and then I just have to suck my ankle. You guys, I'm gonna die. Oh, wait a minute. I wonder if the guy from Google will suck my ankle in an emergency. Somehow I take a couple of steps forward and I see that it's just a rope off somebody's saddlebag. What caused my stress? Was that rope that concerning? Was it the rope or my story? How often do you turn ropes into snakes? I know. I'm a drama researcher 2.5 hours every single day. So I'd ask you, what do you know for sure? It will loosen your ego's grip on you. I know that it's a rope. And I would encourage you to stop believing everything you think. When you're judging, you're not serving, you're not leading, you're not adding value. I have an Ask Cy show, Facebook Watch. It's called Life's Messy, Live Happy. I get hundreds of questions, and almost every question is, how do I make this other person change? This other person's micromanaging. This other person is. This other person. What should I do? How do I get them to be less negative? How? Do you see the obvious problem in all of that? Is I am awesome. My problem is them. Instead of how do I maintain my happiness, even in this weird world where some people are happier than me and some people are less happy than me, but I'm relatively unaffected. All the things that you want, innovation, collaboration, teamwork, results, engagement, you're being told that you have to train people up on these. You have to develop people in these. You have to develop yourself in these. But I'm here to tell you that's not true. All of those things are your natural state once the drama's gone. Your job as a leader isn't to make people this. When they're in high self, it's their natural state. Michelangelo was asked, after he carved the beautiful masterpiece David, whether it was hard or not. He said, no, it wasn't hard. I just removed from the marble everything that wasn't David. Your job as a leader is not to have to make people into something. It is simply removing all that isn't their high self, removing all that is drama. And I'll leave you with one of my favorite quotes. Out beyond the ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is this incredible field, and I'd love to meet you there. And that field is all about no ego and how you can get into high self and how you can work. There's workplaces like this. So if you are interested in what you heard, the good news is we believe in abundance. We give it all away. I have a podcast called No Ego. We have tons of stuff on social media. Just look at Cy Wakeman. If you want to be part of our network, just text the word reality to 96,000, and we'll get you included. We don't sell you things. We just feed you. So thank you so much.